Sure.
Okay, this is the 23rd of April, 2012.
And a stormy day.
We're sitting on the southwest side of Louisville, a lovely hilltop overlooking Dixie Highway and Dawn Drive. And I'm talking with Ray Shelton, a legend in Louisville broadcasting, and the first television announcer at WHAS. Is announcer the right title, or were you the do everything, or what were you?
I was to do everything, Jack, but I was an announcer.
Now, let's talk about you first of all. You're originally from Louisville.
Louisville, yeah.
And you grew up here. Where did you attend school?
DuPont Manual.
Mm-hmm.
And then went on to U of L.
What area of town did you grow up in?
What area of town? Taylor and Barry Boulevard.
Okay. Then you went on to University of Louisville.
Yeah, and got an A.B., and then decided I wanted to do some work with the FBI.
Really? I didn't know that.
Big thoughts.
You mean you wanted to be an Elliot Ness, or you want to be a lawyer with them?
Well, aspirations at least to work with detective activities.
Really?
And so I went to law school, but about halfway through law school, I found out that a good majority of FBI agents don't even get out to do anything. They look through books all day long.
And that wasn't your original intention, huh?
So I went ahead and finished the law school and went to Lexington, took the bar, and it passed, interestingly enough. So then I had to practice or do something to make it worthwhile. So that's basically...
So you did practice law for a while?
Then? Yeah. I took wills and estate work, drafting the will. Sometimes you would get it back, and sometimes it was never produced by the deceased or the relatives. But it was good, interesting, clean work. There was no arguing in court, no Frank Haddad type activity.
So that really prepared you for a long career in broadcasting, then, didn't it?
Yeah, except I'd start out in the wrong position.
Well, now, how did you get connected with broadcasting? Had you was that thought ever in your mind as you were preparing for a career with the FBI, or?
No, actually, if the older, nicer lady came up and asked me, "What do you want to be, little boy, when you grow up?"
Mm-hmm.
I would have shouted back, "On the radio, lady."
Is that right? Really? Now, what prompted that?
Well, I had no other interests, really. I admired the network people that I'd listened to as a kid.
Lot,
sure.
Yeah.
Nothing but network radio then. And so I thought, I can do that well. I can say, this is the CBS radio network.
Now,
I learned how to do that.
During that young time, did anyone ever say to you, "You ought to be on the radio. You've got this great voice."
Oh, yeah. I tell you, had a great voice. And I knew all the while it takes more than a great voice. Mm-hmm. You and I have learned that it takes phrasing, for one thing. And, of course, the ability to come up with the right word at the right time. And today I'm fighting a hoarse sensation on the throat, so we'll have to go ahead without it.
But you did have that. That was at least in your mind at one time.
Yeah, right? There was no doubt what I wanted to do.
You could do that. And
yeah, it was a passing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a couple of jobs while in school at Lexington. One was at a small radio station there, and one was with a station that Happy Chandler owned. Governor twice of Kentucky.
Sure.
It wasn't a well-run station. It didn't make money, but Happy sold it and is now WVLK, the outstanding Lexington radio station.
Wow.
So I got out well before it changed hands and thought, where do I go from here? And I got on at WLOU, which I did not know about, but it was about to go black.
That's here in Louisville.
Yes, here in Louisville.
Where were they on the dial, do you recall?
1350.
Still the same position.
And they had studios and their tower out by the Parkmore, Eastern Parkway.
Oh, yeah, 3rd and Eastern Parkway.
Yeah, that tower has come down now.
Mm-hmm.
But they basically were out there, and I worked there about 6 or 8 months.
What did you do there?
Just general disc jockey work. Mm-hmm. That was the thing. Big band music was mm-hmm. in then. Mm-hmm. I'm talking now about 1949. Mm-hmm. And one day an announcer there by the name of Cliff Mercer, who went on to Chicago, said, "Ray, did you know HAS is going on with a television station?" And I said, "No, but thanks for the tip." And he said, "Well, I went in and talked to Paul Clark, but he didn't like me. So why don't you try out? I don't think you'll be well liked either." So it was on a challenge that I went to HAS.
Is that right? Now, of course, HAS radio was big at that
time. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very, very
But
big.
I was shooting for the TV job.
Right. Now, why were they not just bringing some of the TV people, radio people over to TV?
Probably they wouldn't work for the money they were offered.
So this is a new venture. Then.
Yeah.
Now, were there other television stations? Was Wave on the air at that time, Wave Television?
Yes, Wave.
But they were a new venture also.
They've been on about a year and a half.
Okay.
But I was trying at HAS, and he said, "Go on up and audition." Said, "Paul Clark's got a deep voice. Said, I don't think you can match him." And I said, "I don't think I need to." So I did call. And I did walk into those studios.
Where were the studios?
Sixth Street.
Sixth and Broadway, where the Courier-Journal
building right, is. Mm-hmm. They were in the sixth floor there. Mm-hmm. So I went up, and of course, to say nervous would be certainly an understatement.
Sure.
But Paul Clark walked out and said, "Well, we're glad you came in, because we've listened to about 30 people. And some are local people that we knew, but we still haven't found a person we like." So I said, "Well, that's good." And he said, "Go on into the studio."
That was just a regular radio studio you went into
yeah.
at that time? Mm-hmm.
One of, I think they've got about six or seven at HAS radio. And I thought, my, I've come from a 1,000-watt station at WLOU where there was no studio except the control room. And now here I am looking at seven studios. And I was overwhelmed, Jack, to say the least.
Did you know any of the people there? I mean, you knew of them, but did you know any of them?
No, I didn't have any help, didn't have anybody to look to.
Interesting.
Except that Paul was a very nice person as our chief announcer. As Milton Metz often says, there are no chief announcers anymore, and he's right. But Paul said, "We've got it set up. I'm going to listen to you first if I can." And I've forgotten the nature of the copy, because it was one of these things where you're trembling to some degree.
Was it a commercial, or was it news news material?
It was a little news, a couple of articles, and a couple of commercials. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Now, we don't have the cameras set up yet, but I've got that music stand across the studio. Why don't you look up and pretend that's the camera?"
Oh, so that's right. This was for television, yeah. But they had no camera at that
point. No, they weren't ready. Couldn't take me into the actual studio. So I thought to myself, well, sure, I can read to a music stand, which
so
I did.
So this was not just voice. I mean, this had to do with your demeanor, your
right.
looks, and how you carried yourself and
right.
everything. Yeah.
I have no idea how I was dressed, but I probably wasn't ready for TV. But I did that bit, and he said, "You know, I like the way you sound, and you got a good face, Ray. Hold on a minute, I've got to call in Ralph Hansen." He was our program director. And I said, "Okay." So I sat there and nervously did the audition for the second time. Don't know whether it was better or not. But the two of those got on the telephone and called another party, who happened to be an Easterner who came down and was the general manager of the new TV venture. And he listened. And then he came out and he said, "Ray, we like the way you sound. We think you're a good possibility, but my wife is on a parking meter down on 6th Street. I'm going to call you Monday." And you've had that anticipation yourself, I'm sure. Doing an audition. Did I win or didn't I win? So they called Monday and said, "Can you be here in 10 days? So that was the beginning of my career.
Wow.
At
wow.
HAS. Huh. March 27th, 1950.
March 27th, 1950.
The middle of the century, Jack.
Yeah. How about that?
I said, "Yes, I can be here, but
What did you have to do to arrange to get there? Just give notice at your radio job?
And, sure. Mm-hmm. They weren't expecting much because they weren't much to begin with. So I said, I'll be there. And I said, now I've got to remind you, I was doing only radio out of WLOU, never done any TV. Said, well, if you've got some nice clothes, we've got a staff. None of them have worked television either.
So you're pioneering here, aren't you? How prevalent was television in the market? Wave was on. Did you have a television set?
No.
Had you seen television?
No.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was not very prevalent.
Sure.
I imagine there were a few thousand sets across Louisville, but I had no idea what to do or what to expect. And the biggest problem is I'm not a fast reader. As a result, I knew that I would have to write out the copy and do a good bit of memorizing in order to do it. But we went on the air March 27th, 1950.
So that's when you went on the air?
Yep.
Wow. So they had their cameras ready by that time, obviously.
Had the cameras ready, and we had a few engineers.
You remember the first day, what it was like?
Yeah, because it was pretty well rehearsed. We'd had a week to get ready. Copy was in the books, and it was a short day. We invited up the Cozair group to put on a little parade to celebrate our opening on the air. And then we previewed six or eight of the top local shows we would be doing for the audience, mm-hmm. those who might have had a set and be listening. Hmm. It truly was a nerve-wracking day.
What time of day was this that you signed on, or you had your first broadcast? What time of day?
4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. We did nothing till then.
Had they publicized it before? Had they?
Yeah, the Courier, of course, owning the station, mm-hmm. gave pretty good publicity. But the next day was what we call Black Tuesday, having signed on a Monday, because all of our getting ready and rehearsal for the first day on the air reflected on Tuesday because nothing was ready. And as they said, we had more dark screen than programming going out on the air. That was the truth.
What were the hours of programming supposed to be from 4 o'clock?
4 o'clock till 10.
4 o'clock. And, well, and during that time, did you obviously had network?
No, there was no network. Wow. No. So we had the filmed shows.
Mm-hmm. You remember some of the names of the programs?
Yeah, the Streetman Playhouse, sponsored by the Streetman Biscuit Company. I led Three Lives, and then there was Badge 714.
Sure.
With what was his name?
Was that Jack Webb? Was that
Jack Webb was on one, but everything had to be either brought in or originated.
Was it a film? Was that what it was?
No, it was called a kinescope.
Kinescope.
Very bad black and white reproduction. And the delay was such that if Ed Sullivan performed Sunday nights in New York, which he did, we'd get it from a Greyhound bus on Wednesday.
Eagerly anticipated, I'm
yes,
sure.
But it was very primitive, Jack. And then when you got to news and sports, they were just red with a few still pictures.
That was you doing
flashed
it, though.
Up.
That was you
yes.
doing the news.
I did the news. I didn't do sports. We had a sportsman.
Well, you did. So I was going to ask, were you the only on-air personality?
Only on-air. They said, we like your work, Ray. We're going to let you do everything. And I thought, well, what's this all about? But I got to sign it on, do all of the announcing in between, do all of the commercials, and then sign it off at 10:05 after 5 minutes of late news, which I simply sat there and read the copy.
Did you have to prepare the news?
Or no.
Somebody else prepared?
The newsroom did
came
bring
from, like,
up
the radio
news.
Newsroom or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They brought up news, handed it to you, and you read it as best you could, looking up, of course, looking at that music stand all the while, but now we were on the air
and
with
you're
it.
Holding copy, and you're yeah. holding and looking at the copy, yeah. and having a look in the camera.
Nothing
too.
Else you could do,
sure. but
because they would bring up the last page or two while you were on the air, slipping it in on the desk.
So you sat at the desk. And
so I thought, boy, this is really a test.
How about that?
I'm in TV, but I'm not sure. But as long as they didn't complain, I was ready to go.
So what your hours were, you would come in that you went on the air at 4. You obviously came in earlier.
About 3.
Okay, and what kind of preparation did you do?
To get ready for the shows, you'd look over your commercials. But there was nothing much to do except to be ready to be called to the booth if they had problems. And there were a lot of interruptions. A film would break.
Mm-hmm. And what happened then?
Well, they shouted, "Announcer," and the announcer is out having a Coke or whatever. He got in as quickly as he could, because I thought, boy, what an operation.
Now, with these commercials, were you on camera doing those, or were you in a booth, or do they vary? Or
there were both kinds. You would read voiceover, as we call it.
And they would show slides or pictures or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then were they actually slides, or were they a camera just taking a picture of a...
It was a camera actually taking a picture off
of a tripod or something.
Off a tripod,
wow,
yeah.
Wow.
Pretty basic.
Yeah, yeah.
But people who wanted to be on TV paid a little bit of money to be on television. Huh. We had a jewelry store, Will Sales Incorporated, and they sponsored a full half-hour show with Jim Walton called Walton Calling. It was a carryover from his radio show.
Oh, Jim was on radio, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was a carryover on that. But it was a pretty popular show, lasted a couple of years, had an audience in.
And what did he do on that program?
Interviewed them and had them do little tricks to see who could win the prize. It, too, was basic.
So they were in the studio, though? They
yeah.
Were, okay.
They were. The only studio show that we did with an audience mm-hmm. that I remember.
What was the studio like? How big was it?
It was a huge one big box, which was a mistake, most of us thought, because if you were doing a show over in one part of this big studio, mm-hmm. you couldn't be rehearsing or performing.
Oh, wow.
At the other end, you'd be heard. It should have been divided up, but it wasn't. Our engineer, Orrin Towner, thought the one big box was the best way to go with it.
One so that's camera?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'd get two, in which case the floor man, of course, would direct you, right or left camera.
Hmm.
But I was often too nervous, even well into the first couple of months, to know what was happening, except that somebody was waving.
You just followed the finger, huh?
His finger back and forth, yeah.
Wow.
But there were lots of live commercials. The problem came in when somebody like Stewart Dry Goods or Kaufman Strauss, our two biggest retailers for women's clothes, if they had models to come in and brought clothes up with a rack full, the studio was pretty well busy and pretty well filled. So basically, we did the best we could at the time.
But all of that even was live, or did they have
sure.
the ability to put that on Kinescope?
No.
It was all live.
No, so. It was all live.
So while a program's going on, or they're changing clothes
sure.
or something.
Back there, behind the screen, that's all we had for them. But basically, we couldn't record on tape until mid-60s.
Oh, really?
We got color tape
sure.
out of the West Coast. Mm-hmm. Bing Crosby backed that up. Has had part of the money on it, was told.
Let's go back to some of the early days, though. We talked about radio, and some of those guys didn't particularly want to come over and be part of this venture.
Right.
Do you remember who some of the radio staff were at that point?
Sure. The big guy was Jim Walton.
Mm-hmm.
Jim had come in from Florida, and he pretty well had command of the radio shows, and... The staff announcers were people like Bud Abbott, not the comedian, but one who had come down from the East. And we had 5 or 6 all-out-of-towners, all older than I, and far more experienced.
Sure.
But they didn't want to come up to TV from the 6th floor.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. It was a matter of not wanting to put on the makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Should you get the phone, or we let it ring?
Oh,
let it ring.
If you need to get it, we'll...
No.
Okay.
Don't think we'll worry about
just
it.
Just live here.
But we had 5 or 6 who finally did share a little bit of the time up there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say up there, You were on, which floor were you on?
Seventh.
You're on the seventh floor, okay.
Sixth floor was radio.
What was the seventh floor before? Was it just an open space, or were
yeah.
the offices up
storage
there?
Storage area.
Is that right?
They just cleaned it out and...
The whole floor or a corner of it? Or?
Yeah, pretty much.
Was there a sales staff or anything at that point?
Oh,
or
yeah.
The radio people selling them?
Some of the radio people switched over to TV.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how much. I don't think they got very much for a TV commercial because you couldn't boast there was much of a
sure,
leadership.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anybody watching it.
Hmm. When did you first start feeling comfortable doing what you were doing?
Oh, I'd say a year or so in because it was always something new, and they gave me a chance to create and produce a half-hour show for Sundays.
Oh,
you remember there was no cable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way of getting programming at all, so we had to do it. And Sunday was a day when CBS Network, of which we were the affiliate, of course, there was no programming coming down. So we created shows on Sunday. Ken Meeker, one of our announcers, and myself had a show each. I did one called According to the Law because I'd been to law school.
Sure.
And basically I invited attorneys in the local area to come in, please, and answer questions that the public might phone in. So they did that, and that was a good half-hour filled.
When they phoned in, were they put on the air, or somebody wrote it down and gave you the question? Did they have the ability to put it on the air then, the phone call?
We put it on the air, but we had somebody read them first,
mm-hmm.
because you had to avoid answering a personal question,
okay.
A wife who had been left by her husband,
mm-hmm.
or something of that kind, and you also had to avoid giving legal advice. You were there simply to inform the public about what the law
sure.
was,
mm-hmm.
without giving advice. So According to the Law got a silver gavel in New York, and our main man in the main office, Mr. Victor A. Scholes, went to New York to get the gavel. I thought I might like to go, but I wasn't invited.
It was your program, and you created it.
But you know that story,
Jack. Did you
Jack.
Ever get the gavel itself?
Yes,
like, oh,
we
well,
did.
That's good.
And I got the gavel when they changed studios. I guess it was about 1961 we moved to Chestnut Street.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we also ought to go back a little bit and pick up the fact that in 1953, the channel changed. We came on the air as Channel 9.
I didn't know that.
And WAVE was on Channel 5.
Mm-hmm.
So WAVE was allocated by the FCC to go to 3, and we were told to move up to 11. I don't know technically what that meant, if anything.
Did it affect your operation at all?
No, I don't think
from
so.
From your standpoint,
yeah.
No effect.
All of the literature and your sales mm-hmm. things had to be revised, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, that was one of the big moves to change channel. And then we'd increase power. In the mid or late 50s, we became the most powerful TV station in the country.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know, again, technically what that meant, but we were able to enlarge our coverage circle, that is, the area we could be seen in with an ordinary rooftop antenna or something larger. We were able to go out another 20 to 30 miles. I'll never forget a card I got. And you get a lot of mail when you're on TV.
Sure.
A card that I got from a lady, probably from a rural area, who had just gotten her TV set. I'm sure it was black and white and probably a 12-inch screen. But she said, "Ray, we like your programs. I listen to you all the time. And I wondered, I've been sitting in front of the TV set. Can you see the new dress I have?" And I thought, you know, this is both a shame and also a little humorous.
Well, it's humorous, but she admits she had a relationship. You know, they were,
sure,
they
she
were
did.
Tuning into
and
it.
That's yeah, exactly that's what you wanted.
Sure, yeah.
Except there was no way you could look through the screen and reverse the process.
Did you answer that at all?
Or? I can't remember, yeah. Jack, whether I did or not. That's the lady who wanted me to see her dress.
Well, I'm sure with your legal background, it would have been the perfect answer. That's something. Now, when did you start feeling like the television station was making an impact? For example, you know, radio, people had no idea what you looked like.
No.
And you would meet people, and they would say, oh, that's what you look like. But on television, they saw you. Did you start having people recognize you in the community?
Yes, and you were proud of that.
Or are you that guy on television? Or
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Because you're up there every night, and some nights doing the late news at 5 minutes after 10, you wonder, is there anybody watching this thing on the other end? So when someone would come up, or in a restaurant, come over and say, I believe I see you on TV. You were proud.
Sure.
At least
do you remember the first time it happened? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember that, but I remember I used to go to the Blue Boar Cafeteria, and there were quite a few people would come in there. Yes, sitting
there
having dinner. And I didn't mind being interrupted. We hear the stories now of the Hollywood crew, who, of course, don't want to be followed or touched or anything else. But I was very happy to get that response.
Sure, that was recognition. That was proof that something was happening.
One of the other things that might be interesting would be the Crusade for Children, which, of course, Channel 11 did from the first year or two on the air, as I remember, and always brought in the early stages of the Crusade, 50s, 60s, and 70s, a person of national repute. You would know him from network television, or he had a part on a syndicated show. And I remember the first shows that went on were scripted by, again, Mr. Victor A. Sholas, the fellow, our main man. And he would script the first hour of the show only. But we paraded in front of the cameras. We paraded the stars who were going to be seen for the next 18 or 24 hours. And one of those stars happened to be the now famous, and now deceased actually, Merv Griffin, who was there. Merv had been a big band singer with one of the dance bands, and he was sort of in between assignments. He was no longer singing, but he was acquiring some real estate and that sort of thing. So after he's getting a few good bits of applause for his jokes, he kept going on. And Jim Walton walked over to me. He was the main MC and said, Ray, we've got to get him off. We're over time. And Sholas is giving me the old cut signal of the throat. He said, I want you to read cards of the people who have pledged. And I'm just going to walk out there and take Merv Griffin by the arm and take his microphone. We'll share, and I'll walk him off the stage. And he did it.
Oh,
and I've often thought of that because now, before his death, of course, a billionaire who used to compete with Donald Trump to see who could be richer, I think. But those two really did the real estate bit for a while. So we had to get rid of...
He was escorted off the air.
We had to get, just walked him right off the air.
And of course, wanted to have a fabulous television career of his own, really.
I know.
And everything else.
Sure, yeah. Sure he did. There was one other incident. Do you remember the name of the fellow on the MASH series who played the colonel before the present colonel who ended the series?
Yes.
Was it McLean Stevenson?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Okay, it's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and McLean is our guest of honor. But there's not much to do on stage because the little trio that hung on and kept playing over and over to keep the thing going had pretty well worn out. But McLean Stevenson came to me at Memorial Auditorium, and he said, you know, I bet you didn't know, Ray, that I was a pole vaulter when I was in high school. I said, really? He said, no. He said, if you could find me a cane pole about 12 feet long, he says, I'll show you how to pole vault over the orchestra pit. And I said, okay, I think that would be interesting. And Bob Pilkington was our technician. not technician, but director. And I alerted him that McLean Stevenson is going to pole vault over the orchestra pit and onto the stage. You better clear out a few of the music stands. And so he said, okay, we'll be ready for him. We went to the basement memorial. We found a cane pole inside a rug. They're often come that way,
sure,
12-foot
the
rug. Sure. The rug was wrapped around it. So I gave it to McLean. He said, well, now clear out and get your cameras ready for a cover shot. He said, I'm going to run down the aisle here at Memorial Auditorium, hit the pole vault, and go over and land on stage. Well, the pole vault that I gave him, the cane pole, broke.
Was it a cane pole? Was it a vaulting pole?
He landed in the orchestra pit, and I don't think he was hurt, or he would have hollered a little more. But I thought, I should not take up anybody offer of
I've
that
kind.
I've
never heard that story before. That's a great story. And live television.
Yep.
Live television. Oh, goodness. Well, let me ask you about, you started Bare Bones. You were the one, you had a camera person, I guess, and a director. How long did it take to evolve to enlarge the staff and start getting, it happened fairly quickly, didn't it?
Yeah, we became, I think, at WHAS-TV. I think we had the largest television staff in the state.
How many people would that be?
I don't know, Jack, probably 50 or 60.
Really?
On staff, yeah. And as you know, a small radio station can operate now with six or eight people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it was a very, very full staff. They were good, talented people. And
were more of the radio people by this time wanting to get in on the act?
Uh-huh. They were coming up and doing some TV. Got used to wearing that Max Factor makeup that I had to wear.
When did you start doing that? From the start or putting the makeup on? That was from the start.
In the black and white days, the makeup was required more than color TV.
Really?
Yeah.
Because of shadows and things?
Mm-hmm. You wore Max Factor number 5 pancake. Huh. Put it on with a sponge.
Put it on yourself?
Or yeah. Didn't have any makeup people. Huh. But that, they, staff, I would say, enlarged pretty quickly, mm-hmm. and we produced some good shows.
You remember some of the shows that were locally done before you started? Do you remember when you first started, or when you realized that the networks came along and they were taking over more and more? Was CBS the network?
CBS.
Okay.
And of course, by that time,
I remember a DuPont network, but that was prior to that.
That was an early one. That's where Jackie Gleason started, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. on DuPont, and then moved. Moved to CBS.
CBS from the start.
That's right. But basically, CBS would feed more shows. And of course, we were getting shows from the West Coast at that time. We weren't able to get it over the mountains. They didn't have the system of towers established. So mainly, we were getting shows from New York early, and then later from the West Coast.
How were they coming? How were they delivered?
They were on line, fiber optic line from the East Coast, but I think from tower to tower over the Rocky Mountains.
Really? Seems like I remember, did you get a lot of films and things like that at one point? Were a lot of programs on film? I remember big canisters up in the video room or something. Were those shipped in, or do you recall that at all, or?
Yeah, that would have been syndicated shows, such as I Led Three Lives and Badge 714 and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you played them on a certain night in the public.
But the others were live, they were coming in.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But basically it was delay early and then live feeds across the Rocky Mountains, your area of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to jump the hump there and get shows from the West Coast.
When did you start to expand into local news coverage and, you know, do the network, or the news, local newscasts began to beef up and do sports and weather and things like that?
Well, we didn't have the capacity nor the equipment early on, but I would say within 5 years or so, we were able to have newsreel cameras that shot film, and then we had a crew that would develop the film.
Well, it had to be developed, that's right.
Yes, develop it on site. and then show it, of course, on the news.
Edited and divided.
Yes, edited and show it on the news, both early at 6 and then again at 10 or 11. I've forgotten which it was at that time.
As it grew and more staff came on, what were your duties? What were your continuing? Did that expand, or did you take up more duties? Or
no,
you did the weather for a long, long time.
Did the weather, but Milton Metz was the main weatherman.
Really?
Milton came up with his concept of the weather board. And then, of course, he had the ice box and the oven on the weather map.
Okay.
And it seemed the oven was always someplace in Southern California. Needles, I think, got the oven all the time. And then he came up with, that's the way the weather vane points tonight. That's his phrase. And he did weather principally, but I stepped in and did it sometimes on the early when he would do it a late show. But he was our weather crew. And basically, the announcer of, I guess his duty would actually have shrunken, if that's the phrase, with the other shows developing. I think basically he was still needed, and you could create, and you could be ready for booth work, whatever is required there, voiceover, or that sort of thing.
Did you do some of the booth work? Did you do some of that?
Yeah. You would have to do a few. It was early for drop-ins. It was early to have a pre-recorded station break. Generally, we had a live booth long after others because the finances had given it up and gone to pre-recording all of the station breaks and other announcements for the day. Man would sit down for a couple of hours in the booth and just turn pages and do one after another.
Well, that's a little, have a little digression here or a little detour. You talked about some of that was because of finances, but that the Binghams didn't do that, did they?
No.
The Binghams always, I don't know if money was not a problem with them or what, but they held on to things like that for a long, long time.
They liked production. They liked a live announcer. And as a result, we stayed with what might be considered by some as old-fashioned, along after the others.
Now, the Binghams, of course, were the people who owned the Courier-Journal, radio television station. You had a long association with them.
I don't think they worried about finances, and they were excellent people to work for.
Did you see them often? Were you,
Barry Jr. often would come to the studios because that was one of his loves, was television and radio. Barry Sr. you would see at Crusade for Children time, and he would always come by and shake the hands of those who opened the Crusade Saturday night at 10 o'clock. That was the opening hour. He was a gentleman, great speaker, and certainly one to be admired, Barry Sr. Barry Jr. would come around and comment and maybe offer some suggestions from time to time.
The as the television grew, you evolved, I guess. Of course, you brought more television people in. You still involved a lot of the radio people. And at that point, you were still all in the Courier-Journal building at 6th and Chestnut. Was there good camaraderie between radio and television?
Pretty good. People we didn't get acquainted with were the press people from down on the first and second floors.
Newspaper people.
Yes. They were there in the lunchroom along with us, but we didn't seem to mix much. But the radio and TV people all used the restaurant facilities there.
Well, they had a cafeteria right there.
Yeah.
Let's go back a minute to some of the people who were not necessarily there first, but as it began to grow, you mentioned Bob Pilkington. Do you remember some of the other people who were directors or who were camera people or producers or anything like that, or program directors over the years?
Program director was Ralph Hansen all of the time I was there.
Was he hired specifically for television at that point?
Yeah, he came in from St. Louis and was the program director. And basically, during most of the years I was there, it was Hansen in charge. I'm trying to think of other producers that whose name's escaped me. Pilkington. Pilkington was the main.
He's still coming back and does the Crusade.
Yeah, I know.
For years later.
Yeah, he's a great producer.
He is, yeah. Were you involved in some of the early programs? I remember Hayloft Playdown, and of course you had. I had at that point. At some point, they began to produce live music and had orchestras and things like that.
Yeah, they did. In the early days when I went there, they have a full live orchestra for radio.
Did some of them get a splash into television then? Did they do some of that locally on television?
They had, yes. We had one night on Friday nights in which we did a show with talent coming over from the Brown Hotel. And it was a full half-hour show, and the orchestra was there. And we had a vocalist by the name of Roz Marquis, who at one time in her earlier years had been the vocalist with the Louisville trumpeter, Sugar Blues.
Clyde McCoy,
thank you. That's his name. She had sung with him, and she was very good, and that was sponsored by one of the beer commercials. And I guess it went on 5 or 6 years. It was strictly a local show and a high-class show.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you just mentioned commercials. In live days of live television, and were you ever have some moments you remember of doing live commercials and things not going exactly as they were planned?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember any of those?
We had our shares of that. First of all, having come from a Baptist background, my family had fits when they told them that the Fair's Beer Company, Louisville, wanted me to have a tall pilsner, is that the name of the glass, of Fair's on the table and come up and take a sip. Now, nowadays, that's done all the time. I hear the talent endorsing products. But then the Bingham said no. We don't want the announcer endorsing a product. Don't say I drive a Ford because it's a good car. And so there was some opposition to my drinking the beer. Furthermore, my family did not approve of it. So they went to black when I raised the glass and stopped there.
So they would see you start in the motion, but they didn't actually see you drink the beer.
But we had a lot of commercials that were... not what they should have been.
Or having to ad lib or something, or something going wrong and you having to ad lib.
One involved my friend Milton Metz.
Oh, really?
He had just gotten the commercial for the weather show, 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. Pepsi Cola was sponsoring it, and he was proud to have him in from New York in the sponsor's booth watching up from on high.
Wow.
And so when it comes time to talk about Pepsi Cola, we have had it put in the floor director, had it put in the refrigerator so that it would be easily accessible. He uncorked it as he ran across the stage floor, handed it to Milton, and as Milton said, I am proud to present my new sponsor, Pepsi Cola, and there it was, a bottle of Coca-Cola with undeniable shaped bottle. I do not know what he said, but I know it was embarrassing, and needless to say, Pepsi didn't come back for a while.
And that engineer or floor producer probably has some explaining.
That's right.
To you too, huh?
Wow. There's lots of opportunities to, in live days of television, to mess up. It was always wise to, for instance, uncap a soft drink bottle ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you might be there fumbling with it for a good long while.
And foaming over.
Yeah. So I always uncapped it and covered it with my thumb so that you couldn't tell that it was loose and that sort of thing.
Well, now I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit here, but the idea of talent not endorsing something, I remember for years you were the spokesperson for Greater Louisville. You did those commercials live on the news every night.
That was the big one, Jack, and I'm
did that for years.
Forever thankful to Gustav Flexner and Greater Louisville First Federal Savings and Loan. I did those commercials live for 40 years.
Is that right? You still have some of the copy going through your head at night?
Yeah, sure. Still can say the phrases.
Any phrases come to your mind right off?
Tonight's news brought to you by Great Financial Federal. And at that time, we were a $10 million insured organization. Now we've surpassed that and gone on to be U.S. Bank, the fifth largest bank in the country. They were bought out by several, Star Bank and some other banks. But I did those live. I went in on
40 years, wow.
I went in on a Saturday night, even if I was out having dinner or a party. I had to break loose and do the 11 o'clock commercial because I promised I would do it.
Wow.
To Flexner.
Sure.
And it paid off because he liked me. He was the owner of Great Financial. Greater Louisville than Great Financial. So basically he was faithful to me and I was faithful to them.
Well, even when you left the station, you were a spokesperson for them for years.
I kept on doing them until 19, I don't know the year. But it was 20. I was 25 years at the station, and another 15 doing public relations work, but not on staff.
Well, let's talk some more about you were there in the studios at in the Courier Journal building at 6th and Broadway. Then they built this new palace just up the street at 6th and Chestnut.
Right.
What was the move like going from there?
Well, we had several people helping. Back to Bob Pilkington, he was in charge of the parrot that we used on a show.
I don't think I know about the
parrot. Lolita the parrot.
Tell me about the parrot.
The parrot was part of T-Bar V, which was a daily show at 4 o'clock.
This was the kids' show?
That's right, in which they invited the kids up. But Lolita would talk constantly, as parrots do, and either Cactus, Tom Brooks, or Randy Atcher would holler back, and the parrot would parrot back. So she was a part of T-Bar V for many years. But Bob was in charge of taking care of Lolita in her cage in that procession that we had from 6th and Broadway to 6th and Chestnut. Had a group, because they were moving stuff that could be moved. But it was a good move because we had good studios. Separate studios. Modern equipment.
A lot of room.
Parking out back.
Oh, yeah.
It was a good move.
What were you doing during this time? This was in the early 60s, middle
61 and 62.
Okay.
We were made the move. I was still doing Great Financial commercials, of course, and then the others that came along.
Now, you were doing some radio at this time, too, weren't
sure.
you? Yeah, because people were going back. Well, what radio were you doing then?
Well, I took the TV show and made it into a radio show and used the Louisville Bar Association attorneys and did the
this
same thing
on
radio. Yeah, did a half hour for radio. Same idea. So you can always keep busy, and ironically, Jack, the fees paid were small unless you created the show. So I made a $19 fee for doing a half hour once a week, and I made a $3.50 fee for doing Great Financial Federal every night of the week. It's interesting looking back, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, but at that time, that was pretty good for back then.
Milton and I competed in some commercials. I'm sure he might have mentioned that in his part. Excuse me.
You'll have been friends for a long time, haven't you?
Yeah, we have been. We had a little business together called Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Opened a shop up here in Shively.
Huh.
Yeah. And went for about 6 months. But anyway, Milton and I were involved in the only commercial that I know of where neither of us had to smile or say anything. It was the Palm Beach Clothing Company, makers of men's suits, came to town and said, we want to know who you've got that would look pretty good in a 40 regular suit. And they put the memo up. Milton answered and I answered. And all we had to do was walk in front of the camera and parade wearing one of their Palm Beach sport coats. Who looks best in a Palm Beach coat? No words were uttered. I won the audition. I got, proud to say, a thief all the way from Palm Beach, Florida, to St. Louis. Each city of any size would pay a small fee.
Wow.
Because the unions had control of some of those cities. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. No words uttered.
Now, when you did the commercials, where you just walked through and that's all you had to do for Palm Beach?
Yeah, always. I have a picture here. Here's the set.
Oh, my goodness.
You see, they allowed because they liked Gus Flexner's commercials, and they liked the fee he was paying.
How about that?
I sat in front of that sign every night of the week.
This is Ray sitting at a desk, and the backdrop, which looks like you're looking out a window, but it's a backdrop, and it's Greater Louisville First Federal Savings. They're building in the background.
They wouldn't let you do that now.
Yeah. Now, where was that? Was that on 4th Street, or where was that?
His office was 417 West Market.
West Market, okay.
And that's what that was a backdrop.
Yeah. How about that?
They said, move over a little bit. You're hiding the sign.
So you sat at this desk, and that's where you did your news and everything, huh?
Yep.
How about that? That's great. Handsome devil. Handsome. You were right for television, weren't you?
Well, I took him a pretty good face. I guess that's the reason they offered to pay me $60 a week.
All right.
Now, we're going back to 1950.
Yeah, that was a good salary for them, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's very good. Well, you've had a long career. And let's go back to just a little bit about what you did on radio. You did your program. Did you do other things? Of course, you did the Crusade.
Yeah.
Were there other things did they have booth announcing in radio back then at that time?
Did. But most of those shows were well-established people. Phil Sutterfield was our sportsman, and then you had the newsmen who would come over. So it was a matter there of simply introducing the 5 o'clock news brought to you by Yellow Cab.
From a booth there.
Yeah, that was a bit about it. Mm-hmm. And again, this could have been done with a drop-in, a pre-recorded announcement, but the Binghams preferred it being done live. Mm. They were behind times, according to many people in the industry, but they wanted to do it right.
They got the quality they wanted.
Yeah.
Had the control of it.
I did do one that I'm proud of, and I've got to answer, got to comment on that, could I?
Sure. This is your show.
They put a memo up on the bulletin board. Ed Sullivan is coming to Louisville for the very first time. March, I think, 6th, 1953. They are looking for an open and close announcer for the network. And all eight of you who are staff can compete. And, of course, the word got out pretty quickly.
Sure.
And how many do you think competed? 6 out of the 8. We went over and read the copy. He was to come to town and do the Holiday on Ice show. You've seen that one advertised.
Yes.
It was to be done at the rink downtown, which is now Louisville Gardens, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. And so we all got our best voices together and stood up. You've been through the routine. One after another, read the open and the close for the network Sullivan show.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Thought this would be pretty good if you could win this one. I'm not going anywhere, but I may as well audition and try. And so they listened to all of us, and it was a good moment, and I'm still remembering in my mind when the producer of Ed Sullivan's show called out and said, "Want to hear Shelton again?" That's always a good sound.
Sure, yeah.
So he said, "Read the copy again, a little more forcefully, a little brighter than you read it." I tried to do that. And they said, "You will be the announcer for the Ed Sullivan Show."
Wow.
It was interesting, Jack, because the guest that Sunday, and they filmed both an afternoon and evening show, the guest that Sunday, along with others, was Ed Ames of the famous Ames Brothers trio. And during his skating with a pretty girl on each side, he fell down right flat off his behind on the ice. And I thought, standing off to the side, am I supposed to say anything? What do we do now? So they stopped and picked him up and went on as if he had never fallen. And he did his song in the show, and things were fine. And, of course, what they did was to take the afternoon performance and clip out that particular segment where he did not fall.
The ability to edit by that time.
So I was proud to be the opening announcer.
Where did you do that? Were you at the arena? Were you in a booth?
Yeah, we were at the arena.
At the arena. Wow.
Yeah.
So you're standing by a mic?
Standing by there, and you were fairly close. And Ed was probably within a couple of years of passing on, because he sat on the edge of the rink, and his announcer kept saying to the floor man, "Please get Ed up. I want to get a wide shot." And the floor man said, "Well, he'll be mad, you know. He's tired." And they got him up. So it was interesting to watch it.
I want to ask if you had any interaction with him. What was he like?
No, never got to say hello. Never got to say hello. Said hello to his producer, whose name I've forgotten. It's his son-in-law. But it was interesting. They had the kids in the afternoon. And when you told those kids to make all the noise they could to stomp their feet, they did.
Was that your responsibility?
Yeah.
You were
warm-up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Morning.
Yeah.
And then not morning. Day. Afternoon. Evening.
And so your announcement was actually on the network. Then.
I got three talent fees.
Wow.
Don't often get that.
Yeah. Very nice. Very nice. Very nice. Were you involved in the Derby at all? The station had a long tradition of Derby. Did you do any Derby stuff?
No. Jim Walton always went out to cover the Derby for us. Mm-hmm. So I covered staff for him while he went out one day that he was called on. Went to the Flower Garden, is it? Where they can look down on the track.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
Well,
you've had some good memories. You've had some good times there. And
yes.
How long was your career was there? You were there for
25 years,
from 1950 to 1975.
Yeah.
And then, now, would you go back when you did the financials? Did you go back and tape those when you did the commercials? Those, you didn't have to go back and do those live.
No.
Even after you left.
No, they allowed me to tape them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At the HAS studios. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they played because it was said at the time that he is our local most productive sponsor that we have.
Mm-hmm.
He was buying the news 7 days a week. So as a result, we're spending a good bit of money.
Well, you were getting a lot of exposure that way, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's been good chatting with you.
Ed, let me ask you, was your... You have a family. Was your family involved? They gave your stamp of approval and everything as you went through all this?
Oh, yeah. I would have to say wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. As you know, you miss a lot of time with the family.
Mm-hmm. But evenings especially.
Yeah, because I worked the afternoon shift.
Mm-hmm.
When we finally went full shift, it would be 3 to about 1 o'clock after the movie was over. But they endorsed all of that and helped out and got to go to some of the shows, including the Ed Sullivan Show.
Good. So there's perks there, too.
Yeah.
Well, now, did your Baptist parents ever check to make sure that you didn't drink that Pilsner? We saw it go black, but we want to find out.
That one faded after a while.
Yeah, that's good. Well, Ray, it's been a joy to talk with you. Anything else you'd like to add? Anything that in your notes there we didn't cover or... And this is our program, so...
I know. Well, I would just say that as a staff announcer, although they are looked down on by some people, I enjoyed it, my 25 years. Enjoyed the shows they gave me. Enjoyed working for a great family, the Binghams. And enjoyed, in fact, to the point where I was eager to go to work in the afternoons. Not everybody can say that, Jack.
Now, when you walked in that and did that audition that day, and Mr. Hansen said, "My wife's on a meter downstairs. I'll call you on Monday." That had to be a long weekend, wasn't it?
It couldn't be longer.
Now, when you accepted the position on that Monday, you couldn't have known what stretched out ahead, where television was going. No. Did you have doubts at that time, anything about television at all?
Or? No, I was always an eager kid. In fact, the way I got some of my radio jobs early on in Lexington and Louisville was to watch them putting up a radio tower. And I thought, well, it's got to be a radio station. So I would go over and talk to the engineer putting the tower up and say, "What? When are they going on the air? I'm going to apply for a job." So that's eager if there ever was.
So that was always in your blood then? It had to be a very satisfying career to you because you had a long place. Did you ever have thoughts of going someplace else? I mean,
I had a chance to go to New York, 1954. I auditioned up there.
Wow, that would have been a big time.
Yeah, that was on a dare of one of our announcers named Lee Jordan, who said, well, you know, I'm from Hawkinsville, Georgia, and I did the audition for CBS in New York, and they could hear Georgia accent. And he said, they told me, if you're going to be on network, you can't have any accent, because on the West Coast, Florida, New York, anywhere, you've got to be neutral, mm-hmm. which I got to thinking about is true.
Sure.
So he said, why don't you go? And I took up the dare, and I went, and I won the audition.
Wow.
There were three of us picked. It was a summer job. Mm-hmm. They were hiring you. I did the audition live, got in the car, and came back here with my wife, and there was a telegram in the mailbox out there. It said, can you be available the dates of so-and-so to so-and-so? You place number 2 in our competitive audition. They were out of 3. Okay. Number
without
1.
That 3, it came all across the country, though, too.
Yeah. Number 1 won. Number 2, Bill Gillian was his name, was number 2 from Memphis. He went in my place. But my daughter had some health problems at the time. I got to comparing what you could make in New York and how much you'd have to spend, and I decided just to stay in good old Louisville, Kentucky.
Sounds like it was a good choice.
Yep.
Good, good, good. Well, thanks, Ray. Thanks for sharing with us, and appreciate the time, appreciate your service to the community and WHAS over the years.
My pleasure, Jack. Thank you.
Thank you.